America Trends Podcast is part of the MHNR Network. MHNRnetwork.com.
What you're about to experience is one man's quest to see beyond the tumultuous period we're in and to envision what lies just beyond our grasp, yet well within our reach. Welcome to Larry Rifkin's America Trends, where the future has arrived, and it's just in time.
Welcome back to America Trends. It's one of the hottest topics in America today, and so little understood. It's all about the filibuster in the United States Senate. How did a 60-vote threshold come about? Now, I want to tell you this. It's not in the Constitution. Yeah, go look for it if you'd like. It's not even in formal Senate rules. What does a senator have to do today to threaten to filibuster a piece of legislation? Hint, not much. It's not like Jimmy Stewart having to hold the floor in Mr. Smith Goes to Washington. And what's the practical impact of all of this? It's been said that the U.S. Senate today is the graveyard for new federal initiatives. It's a distinction that each party has used when out of power, but has it become a wrecking ball for good ideas? I promise you one thing as you listen to this podcast. Once you complete it, you'll know more about the filibuster than 99% of your friends. Share what you know, and please send them back here to AmericaTrendsPodcast.com for all of this valuable information. Thanks again for listening.
With me on America Trends is Adam Gentleson, and he is the Public Affairs Director at Democracy Forward. More specific to our conversation, he is also the former Deputy Chief of Staff to Senator Harry Reid. Now, you recall that name. He was a one-time majority leader in the U.S. Senate. And Adam, because of his unique perspective on the functioning of the U.S. Senate for the time that he was there, has written a book called Kill Switch, The Rise of the Modern Senate and the Crippling of American Democracy. Now, Adam, you're a young guy, and I'd imagine that having a job like yours was exhilarating. But early on in the book, you describe the U.S. Senate. Now, this is the stuff of legends, of movies and dreams that so many people have, as more like a soul-crushing bureaucracy than a great deliberative body. How so?
Yeah, that's right. And, you know, when I came to the Senate, I was somewhat idealistic. I've been working in politics for already 10 years at that point, so I, you know, wasn't totally sort of wide-eyed about it. I think I had a relatively realistic set of expectations coming in, but what I found was depressing, even by my somewhat cynical expectations. It's, you know, you're told that the Senate is slow moving, so you come to expect that. You're told that it's deliberative and thoughtful, and so these are all sort of what you expect. You don't expect it to be a fast paced place, but you expect there to be wisdom in that deliberation and in that slow pace. And what I found when I was there was the opposite, that this wasn't the slowness or the glacial pace of an institution that was taking time to think through the issues or consider them at length and come up with thoughtful solutions. This was the glacial pace of an institution that was trying, and in many ways intentionally, to gridlock any kind of ability of our government to respond to the challenges that people face today. It was the pace of obstruction. It was the pace of gridlock. And as I explain in the book, it was manufactured to be this way by folks who wanted to obstruct even broad bipartisan common sense solutions that otherwise would have passed and helped address many of the challenges we face today.
It's interesting because you do go back, of course, to the civil rights era when, in fact, we did propose and pass major legislation. Has the calcification of the Senate, and we'll get back to the filibuster, we'll get back to issues of Jim Crow and the like, but was that a period when somehow things worked? And was that because the parties were really big tent, not built on ideology? Help us understand what happened from the 60s on.
Yeah, that's right. Well, so I think that the civil rights era is interesting because, you know, it is obviously great that we passed civil rights bills in the 60s. But one of the things that I found when I was going through the history was that America was actually ready to pass civil rights bills decades before it did. And the only reason it didn't was because of Senate gridlock and some of the trends that now dominate the Senate starting to emerge back in that period. We can talk more about the filibuster specifically later, but I think it's worth noting that in, you know, sort of the early half of the 20th century, while America was building its great middle class and much of post-war America, you know, most issues were dealt with on a timely basis and came up or down for majority votes in the Senate. But civil rights, even though there were civil rights bills, there were federal anti-lynching bills to end poll taxes, and other kinds of civil rights bills that were passing the House of Representatives starting in the 1920s and were ready to be signed by the president and had the support of a majority of senators and even had broad public support. Gallup pulled anti-lynching laws in 1937 and found 72% of the American people in support of it. They were blocked by the Senate. And so while it's great that we passed civil rights bills in the 1960s, America could have been passing civil rights bills starting in the 1920s, 30s, and 40s if it wasn't for the Senate. So I think what happened was, since the 60s, America had started to basically apply much of the gridlock that we applied to civil rights during that period to every other issue. So while every other issue besides civil rights was processed in a timely fashion in the first half of the century, now no issues are processed in a timely fashion, and every issue has to face the same sort of gauntlet of gridlock that civil rights faced. And that's why everything in Washington is so dysfunctional.
Why is it that many of us on the outside look at U.S. senators with a certain awe? We think that these are the best among us who have risen to these positions. We know it's an anti-majoritarian institution by its nature. Wyoming has two senators. California has two. But we've always thought perhaps that the House of Representatives is even more parochial. But in fact, the House, as you describe it, and others, is the place where more action takes place, where more forward-looking things at least go to the Senate and then die there. So what is it about the individuals who rise to that stature or to the institution itself that defines the characteristics that you're talking about?
I think in many ways there's coasting on past glory here. You know, I think that the Senate is an institution that really enjoys embracing its own myths and cloaking itself in its own myths. And part of what I try to do in the book is bust through a lot of those myths and show, you know, how much of what we consider sort of vaunted tradition is really just sort of the detritus of narrow political power plays by some pretty self-interested people. But I think that there was a time when the Senate considered issues thoughtfully. It's always had major problems. It never gave civil rights, as I just, you know, mentioned, the consideration it deserved. But on other issues, you know, it did live up to its reputation in many ways of providing a more thoughtful forum for deliberation on policy issues. But today, I think that you could argue that the House is doing a better job of addressing the needs of America because it's actually passing things. And much of what it passes are not, you know, far left or far right solutions. They're pretty middle of the road, and the Senate is unable to even pass those things. One of the episodes I recount in the book was the failure to pass universal background checks after the Newtown shooting in Connecticut in 2012. And, you know, here is a policy that was supported by a broad bipartisan majority of 55 senators, supported by 90% of the American people. And we didn't pass it because of the use of the modern filibuster raised the threshold for the number of votes it needed to pass from a simple majority to 60 votes. That's a relatively new feature of the Senate. And it was unable to overcome that. So something as simple and as broadly supported as that failed in this institution that is supposed to be the more thoughtful deliberative body.
And I want to get back to that because I think that's a really interesting and horrific example. I live in that area here in Connecticut and know the story painfully well. Let me ask you this. Let me go back to what you have to deem the racist history of the Senate filibuster. It started as a tool of Southern senators upholding slavery, and then became a mechanism to block civil rights legislation, and then it progressed or digressed from there. Take us through it.
Yes, that's right. So I think it's really important just to sort of set a basic understanding here. which is that the filibuster was not supposed to be part of the Senate. And the framers were very clear about this. They wanted the Senate to be deliberative, and they wanted there to be a lot of debate, but they wanted that debate to be, you know, limited in fashion. Mm. You get to this point where you're having an argument with somebody and you start repeating the same ground over and over again. You know, their idea was that when that starts to happen, and when debate ceases to be persuasive and just starts to become a delay tool, at that point, the Senate should have been able to end debate, cast a vote on the issue, and move on. They're also very clear that they wanted every decision point in the Senate to be majority rule, with a small handful of exceptions that they enumerated in the Constitution. They said supermajority thresholds, you know, more than a majority, should be reserved for amendments to the Constitution, treaties, and removal from office. And everything else should be majority rule. So you have a debate, you have both sides get to be heard out. One of the things that makes it different from the House is that the party that's in the numerical minority always gets to have a say. And then when both sides have had their say, you have a vote. The filibuster emerged starting in the middle of the 19th century to try to delay and disrupt that process of give and take, of open debate followed by majority rule debates. And it was primarily forged by a senator named John Calhoun, who is a senator from South Carolina, sort of the scion of the slave power and the spiritual grandfather of the Confederacy. And he saw that the country was marching towards the steady abolition of slavery. And so he needed to increase the power of the numerical minority he represented so that they would have more power to block the progress that the majority was marching towards. And so he invented what we would come to think of as the talking filibuster, where you would sort of stand on the Senate floor, you know, speaking for a long time, reading from the phone book or whatever.
Well, they had Ted Cruz, Green Eggs.
Yes, exactly. I mean, yeah, reading Green Eggs at Hand. I was there for that. it was very boring. But then that filibuster started to evolve. That was sort of the best John Calhoun could do at the time. There was no way to force a vote to have a higher number of votes be required. So all you could do is delay. But then there was a rule introduced in 1917 that was intended to actually help end filibusters because they'd started to become a problem. But some very innovative Southern segregationist senators who saw, as I mentioned before, these civil rights bills that were passing the House, they needed to have a way to increase the power of their obstructionist minority even more. And so they figured out how to take this rule and start to impose it and make it a de facto higher threshold for these bills to clear. At the time, it was 2/3 majority. Today, it's 3/5, and that's why we have this 60-vote threshold. They only applied it to civil rights for the first half of the 20th century, and then it started to become applied to every other issue. But with the Senate sort of backed into this system, it never made an affirmative decision that it could require 60 votes to pass things, and it's actually not the final verdict on the bill that requires 60 votes. It's this procedural hurdle that has come to sort of stand in for the final vote. But it was not supposed to be this way. This runs exactly counter to what the framers intended, because it has the effect of killing off debate, because if you can't get the 60 votes, there's no point in debating it. And it defies the framers' clear desire for the Senate to continue to be a majority rule institution. Well, just to answer your original question, it was the desire to maintain slavery and it was the desire to maintain Jim Crow that provided the driving force to innovate these new uses of obstruction and create the filibuster as we know it today.
Now, Adam, early on in the book, and I've got to tell you that most of us who think we understand politics would really blush at what you said about the cloakroom. In other words, if you went in as an aide and you said, Senator Reid is really not in favor of this bill coming out, and we want to, well, filibuster it in a sense, because all it takes is one individual, and it's not even a rule, it's a procedural reckoning of some sort. You've got to explain this to us, because it seems so casual. It seems so, I don't know, backhanded. It's hard to believe that is what can obstruct pieces of legislation in this very informal manner.
Yeah, so what I would say to your listeners is forget what you think you know about the filibuster. Forget Jimmy Stewart, you know, on the floor of the Senate giving a long speech. Forget even Ted Cruz reading Green Eggs at Hand, because that was sort of staged and wasn't the normal way the filibuster is applied. That is not how the filibuster works today. The way the filibuster works today is much more insidious. The actual vote to pass a bill in the Senate today is still a majority vote. That's what the rules say. However, if a senator desires to do so, they can send an email to their leadership. They could walk in, as you said, and say it in person, but if they didn't feel like it, they could just have their staff send an email or make a phone call saying that they want to filibuster a bill. By sending that email, they throw up a new procedural hurdle in the path of the bill's passed a passage that requires 60 votes instead of the simple majority of 50 votes that the bill actually takes to pass. That act of sending the email throws up that 60-vote hurdle, and in today's partisan polarized environment, many bills, even common sense ones like universal background checks, can't get the 60 votes to clear it. The other thing that 60-vote hurdle does is it gives the party that's out of power, that's in the minority, the ability to wield a veto over anything the majority wants to do. And this creates a perverse political incentive that is irresistible to the party that's out of power. What Mitch McConnell first and foremost showed is that if you're out of power, if you can use obstruction to stop the majority from getting big things done and show that Washington is gridlocked and voters will be upset and irritated, they will then vote to put you, the party out of power, in power in the next election. If you can't pin the blame on them, the voters, you know, don't want to hear excuses. They look to the party in power and say, why did you get anything done? And if you try to blame the guys that are out of power, as we tried to do, they don't want to hear that. So, you know, using this procedural hurdle, what McConnell did essentially was throw that procedural hurdle up in the path of every single piece of business that came before the Senate. Many things couldn't clear it, and they failed on that procedural basis. They never even got to the final vote, which is still a majority, because they couldn't clear that higher procedural hurdle that any individual is able to throw up with as little as sending an email.
I mean, this is really jaw-dropping in a sense because it blunts so many initiatives. Adam Gentleson is with us. The book is called Kill Switch. So let me ask you this, and you know this intimately. Harry Reid had a role in doing away with the filibuster for executive branch appointments and judicial nominations, except the U.S. Supreme Court. Now, why didn't perhaps he go further than that when in the majority?
Well, the simple answer is that we didn't have the votes to do it. And, you know, it's hard to think back to that time, but this was 2013, and President Obama had just won re-election, and there was still a thought that things might go back to normal. President Obama himself predicted that the Tea Party fever would break, in his words, after he was re-elected. And, you know, we decided to change the rules to apply to nominations because the level of obstruction that was happening there was unprecedented. But changing it to apply to legislation as well was a major step, and Democratic senators simply weren't ready to take it. They still thought that Republicans would come around, the Tea Party wave would subside, and bipartisan cooperation would be possible again. Then we proceeded to lose the Senate majority in 2014, and we didn't get it back until this past January. So once we lost the majority in 2014, it was then out of our power to change the rules because we didn't have the votes to do it and we weren't in control of the chamber. So, you know, I think about that time a lot because I wonder if there was more we could have done. But I think that people just weren't quite ready. I think the reality of obstruction in the Republican Party simply haven't settled in. You know, people thought that Jeb Bush was going to be the nominee of the party in 2016, a sort of reasonable middle-of-the-road Republican who would probably compromise with Democrats on a lot of issues like gun control. You know, things didn't really become clear how much things had changed until 2016, and by then it was too late.
Joe Biden, of course, is a creature of the Senate, 36 years in. And so why is it that when he was running for president, he kept saying, well, we'll work together? When he knows that this procedural hurdle, it's not even a rule, it's a procedural hurdle, can blunt just about anything that he might attempt, if that is their choosing. I mean, I know that we're at a point where this discussion about reconciliation is going on for major pieces of legislation, but is Joe Biden going to surprise us all and really encourage the slim Senate majority to, in fact, get rid of this procedural hurdle?
I suspect that he eventually will, and the reason I think that's true is that I think that it's quickly going to become clear that if we don't reform the rules, then most of his agenda is not going to pass, and it's really that simple. And I think that there's no harm in trying for bipartisanship. I mean, you know, the one danger is you run out of time, and I think there is a real danger of that. We saw that in 2009 with President Obama, where chasing Republican support on health care took up most of his first year in office. And he quickly lost a lot of political capital. So you got to keep an eye on the clock. But I think that trying, at least initially, to secure some Republican support is not a bad idea. Maybe there's a blossoming of bipartisanship. I personally think that's unlikely. But once it becomes clear, and once you've tried it a little bit, then I think you're basically faced with a choice between reforming the rules, to allow the Senate to go back to passing things on a majority vote basis, as it did for most of its existence, or getting nothing done. And I think that President Biden, at the end of the day, and some of the things he's saying now are making this clear, he's really focused on delivering the results that he promised he would deliver. And I think that's the right thing to do. You know, Senate rules are important. Rules are important in any institution, but it's also important for those rules to evolve. The primary purpose of the Senate is not to maintain its own rules. The primary purpose of the Senate is to produce thoughtful policy solutions to the challenges we face. And if its rules start to inhibit it from being able to do that, the rules should be changed and reformed, as has happened many times throughout the institution's history. It's an evolving institution, has always changed. And I think that if Republican obstruction becomes manifest, as it seems like it will, it should change its rules again so that it can actually deliver the change that people need.
Well, when you look at some of the extreme folks, particularly on the right, I'm going to say that, I mean, who can basically pocket veto a senator with an email, a piece right. of legislation. I mean, of course, it seems just rational that the body has changed, the politics have changed, and some of these rules have to change. I'd like to go back to Sandy Hook, because there was a compromise that had been built. Explain how beautifully crafted that was, and how the NRA, I think, was behind it, gun safety folks were behind it, and that got blunted.
That's right. I mean, this is basically, you know, what you are taught is should be the way a bill becomes a law. It was sort of a textbook example. You had a Democratic senator, Joe Manchin of West Virginia, sort of a rough-edged populist, join with a senator who could not be more different from him, Senator Pat Toomey of Pennsylvania, sort of your, you know, straight out of Central Casting Country Club Chamber of Commerce Republican. They came together. They formed a bill to impose universal background checks. A policy that was broadly supported by experts on gun safety, that had 90% support among the American public, a poll showed at the time, and it even had the support of a bipartisan majority of senators. It has 55 senators in support, with both Democrats and Republicans making it up. On the group side, yeah, it had support of the left-leaning, you know, Brady campaign to end gun violence, and it had the support of some right-wing groups, although not the NRA, and this was crucial because what ended up happening was the NRA, which is funded by, you know, hundreds of millions of dollars in dark money, launched a major pressure campaign against the bill, and even though no one really debated the bill, that's the Senate is supposed to be the great world's greatest deliberative body. We're supposed to have debate in the chamber. No one really bothered to debate this bill. It was on the floor for about a week. Mitch McConnell, who was leading the opposition, spent a grand total of 2 minutes over the course of a week talking about this bill. Nobody really bothered to explain their opposition, but they did this procedure that we've discussed here where they, you know, someone sent an email that threw up a 60-vote hurdle and the bill is passed the passage. And so 55 senators of both parties, 90% public support, the support of broad range of interest groups, was not enough to pass this bill. And it just failed, and it has never been heard from again. And that we still, to this day, despite the, you know, number of shootings that have happened since then, don't even have as common sense a policy as universal background checks in the country because of this new stealth filibuster.
You say to us in the book that the majority in the Senate gives Democrats now the ability to determine what bills come to the floor, but in a sense it doesn't, or does it?
Well, it gives the minority veto power over anything that gets passed. So Democrats have the power to bring a bill up, you know, and call a vote on it, but they don't have the power to pass it themselves. And it's this minority veto that is the irresistible urge or temptation for the party out of power. And this is interesting because this is something the framers saw. They had firsthand experience with this because in the Articles of Confederation, right, the first draft of American government, the Congress had a supermajority threshold for most categories of legislation. And the framers saw that rather than promote consensus and bipartisanship, this allowed that party out of power or that opposed any given measure to throw a monkey wrench in the system. And so they said in the Federalist Papers and other writings to be wary of this. And how Alexander Hamilton, writing in Federalist 22, said, you know, speaking of supermajority thresholds, that what might at first sight seem a remedy is actually a poison because it doesn't, and now I'm going back to my words, it doesn't actually promote bipartisanship. It, back to his words, allows the minority to substitute the caprices of a minority for the good judgment of a majority, and it allows the minority to embarrass the administration. So they knew that this was a tool that the party out of power would use to make the party in power look bad, to advance the party out of power's own political interests. And that's what you're seeing today.
And to change the procedural hurdle or the rule, and by the way, is it written down anywhere, the filibuster hurdle?
Well, no, not really, because it's sort of a you know, layered combination of you know, there is a rule, but it doesn't say filibuster. It's a rule that was intended for another purpose. And then, you know, over several decades, there's been a layered series of norms and behaviors that have sort of manifested the filibuster. So it's not specifically a rule. And as you said, it can be changed. You know, the Senate can set a new precedent. The Senate operates on this weird combination of written rules, sort of established precedents, and obedience and behavior. So it's a, you know, it's a weird mix of things. But you can basically decide, to change that with a majority vote. The Senate is responsive to the will of itself, and its own will is manifested by a majority of senators voting to do something. So basically tomorrow, if a majority of senators decided to vote that from now on, the Senate would be a majority rule body, and there would be debate and there'd be all the good things that are supposed to happen, but ultimately a bill could pass or fail based on whether it could muster a majority straight down the line, a majority of senators could vote to do that. So that's the good news here, which is that it is possible to change. Democrats have 50 votes themselves. They, along with Vice President Harris, could decide tomorrow to make this change. So while I think, you know, the book provides some history that's a little jarring and maybe somewhat depressing, you know, it ends with a plan to fix it, and it is a realistic plan that could happen tomorrow if 50 senators decide they want to do it.
Well, what is the political calculus and the reason not to do it, assuming that one day you'll be in the minority? And I guess the other question related to this is, what is a healthy role for the minority in terms of obstructing things that might not be good?
Yeah, that's right. I think a healthy role is being able to have a say and reorienting your goal in the minority from obstruction to persuasion. And I think that, you know, if the party that's in power is doing something you oppose, you should have every right to take the Senate floor and use it as a platform to try to convince people to come over to your side, or at least express why you think it's a bad idea. And maybe if you're persuasive enough, you can convince people to come over to your side and you can win the day. That's a healthy role. I also think that when the minority sees policies passing, it may not be what they favor, but the fact is they lost the election, and so they have an opportunity to get involved in the policy and try to influence it and pull it in their direction. Those are healthy roles for the minority. That's what the Senate was supposed to facilitate. But the ability to just block what the majority wants to do, even if it has broad bipartisan support, I saw a poll recently that showed that President Biden's COVID relief package has the support of 83% of the American people. You know, that's bipartisanship right there. And the party that's out of power in the Senate should not be able to wield a veto and block something that has the support of 83% of Americans from passing. To your question about the political calculus, I think that it's important to do things when you have the power to do them. Republicans could choose to get rid of this rule themselves the next time they're in power. So preserving it in the hopes that it will be a tool that's useful for Democrats when they're out of power is probably short-sighted, because Republicans would just get rid of it when they want to. I think Mitch McConnell has shown he's willing to do that. He did it essentially for Supreme Court justices,
right,
when it advantaged him. So I think it's more important to take the opportunity you have to pass things that are broadly popular, that cannot pass unless we reform the filibuster, and also things that help make our elections fairer. Democrats are at a huge disadvantage in every election right now because of voter suppression and because of some of the structural factors that give power to conservatives. Some of those things can be remedied by passing a strengthened Voter Rights Act. The John Lewis Voting Rights Act is something people are talking about a lot, by passing things like statehood for D.C. and Puerto Rico, which would extend representation to majority-minority populations that currently are not represented but are bound by federal laws. And those sorts of things would rebalance our system, make the elections happen on a more level playing field. But the problem is none of them can be done without abolishing the filibuster, because Republicans will always obstruct them and never give Democrats the 10 votes they need to pass them. So that's the choice we have. It's, do you use your power to try to get as much good done as you can? And then, you know, if Republicans win back power, they win back power. But they would probably just get rid of the filibuster themselves and do whatever they wanted when that happened. So I think, you know, you put one foot in front of the other and you do what you can do with the time that you have.
Speaking of that, if Joe Biden is only to be a four-year president, and some speculate that that is the case, though, of course, he's not going to make himself a lame duck at this moment, the question really is, if you see so many problems in our country right now that really need to be addressed and that really have gone to the Senate to die, and you look at that as being your imperative, that if you're going to have a legacy of any sort, you've got to get these things moving. And if you also look at the history of the 20th century, and I think it's fair to say, and Adam, I'd love your reaction to this, that the activism and the desire for change and to reflect demographic and various changes socially in our society, it's the Democratic Party that initiates those and the Republicans that react to them.
That's right. And I think this is one of the key things to understand about the filibuster, because some Democrats are hesitant to get rid of it. But you have to understand this basic dynamic about the parties to see why the ability to obstruct advantages conservatives far more than it advantages liberals and progressives. You know, conservatives are the party, as William F. Buckley famously said, that stands athwart history yelling stop. They want to stop progress. Obviously, there's some things they want to pass, but as we saw under Trump, they got their tax cuts and they got their judges and they were basically happy. Things like expanding civil rights, expanding the social safety net, even things as basic as passing new family leave policies, and climate change, addressing climate change. All of these things are things that we rely on the Democratic Party to do, because the Republican Party has simply decided it's not interested. And none of these things are going to happen as long as the Republican Party wields veto power and can filibuster anything on these issues. You know, we've mentioned reconciliation. You can do a little bit through reconciliation, but it's a pretty narrow set of restrictions that allow you to only do a certain number of things through it. Most things on Biden's agenda cannot be done through reconciliation, and therefore most of them will be blocked by the filibuster. So if you want to see progressive change happen in this country, you have to reform the filibuster, or else you're basically giving up and letting Republicans win.
What about executive action, the imperial presidency, the abdication of Congress in terms of its basic responsibilities, including war making in many cases, just giving power over to the executive branch? What kind of concern do you have that that's just going to continue unabated?
Well, that's an excellent point, which is that, you know, if you are someone who supports a strong legislative branch, you should favor getting rid of the filibuster, because a lot of the reason power has flowed to the imperial presidency is that Congress is gridlocked and can't get anything done. You know, right now it's a challenge for Congress to keep the government's lights on and pass government funding and not shut down once a year. So, you know, the presidency has to step in and start to get things done as best it can. The problem is that executive actions are important tools that can be useful. But there's just no substitute for passing legislation. Executive actions can never be as effective or have as broad a scope as passing new laws. They're also much more vulnerable to legal challenges. So, you know, to have a functional federal government, you have to have a functional legislative branch. You just do. You have to be able to pass laws that have broad bipartisan support and that are common sense solutions to the challenges we face. And if you don't have that, you know, it's like a plumbing system where you've got a clog and the water starts to go to places you don't want it to go. You know, that's what we have in our federal government today. Eventually the pipes burst and you've really got a problem. So, you know, we have to get rid of this clog. We have to restore a functioning legislative branch to have a rational government that can respond in a reasonably timely manner to the challenges that we face today.
So if we were having this conversation 3 years from now, and you know that our focus is on political trends, what might we look forward to, particularly if some of the reforms that you suggest are implemented, or if the crisis of the moment, and there are several that are staring at the new administration, really require some radical adjustment? What do you think we might see?
Well, I hope that what you see, I think, you know, action on climate change and gun control and income inequality are all very important. But I also hope that you see action to actually restore our democratic process, which is under very serious threat right now. It's great that President Biden was declared the winner of the election because he won it. But we still have a lot of problems, and you've seen Republican state governments respond in recent months to Biden's election by tripling down on voter suppression. So we need to restore the Voting Rights Act, which was gutted by a Supreme Court decision recently in the conservative majority there. We need to restore the Voting Rights Act. We need to go even further. We need to have things like automatic voter registration, you know, like a motor voter law where you're registered to vote as soon as you get a driver's license or as soon as you turn 18. We need to make sure that this country lives up to its promise of guaranteeing equal access to the ballot to every single American. We also need to expand representation to places like D.C. and Puerto Rico. People think of D.C. as a town full of lobbyists. It's not. Yeah, Kier, I've lived there for a long time. It is a majority African, it is a majority working class, majority African American city that is bound by federal laws, but can't have any say in that process. I mean, this is basic, you know, taxation without representation, Revolutionary War principles here. It deserves, it has been made very clear it wants to be a state, and it should be a state. Puerto Rico, if it decides it wants self-determination, should also be a state. It's bound by federal laws. It's bigger than 20 other states if it were to enter the union. So we need to make equality of representation a reality in this country and start to try to address some of the serious flaws in our democracy. The Economist magazine recently downgraded America from a full democracy to a flawed democracy, and I think we need to address that urgently if we're going to save our democracy in the longer term.
But if we don't get rid of the kill switch, how can that really happen?
It won't. I mean, that's your answer. It's just not going to happen because all of these policies can't pass the reconciliation, and therefore you need 10 Republicans to come over and join with Democrats to support them in order to get you to 60 votes because you only have 50 Democrats right now. That's just not going to happen. There's really no question about it. And so if the filibuster remains, none of these structural fixes to our democracy are going to pass. It's really that simple. So I think that, you know, if you're on the fence about it, that should be the thing that pushes you over, because we're simply going to exist in this democracy that's tilting towards not a democracy unless we pass some fixes. And this may be our only window in these next 2 years.
Adam Gentleson, thank you so much for being with us today. I recommend the book, of course, quite highly, Kill Switch, The Rise of the Modern Senate and the Crippling of American Democracy. Thanks so much for being with us today on America Trends.
Thank you for having me. It was great to be here.